Hi there. You're listening to the third episode of Philosophical Discursions, a podcast accompanying the blog philosophicaldisquisitions.blogspot.com. In today's episode, I'll be taking a look at a paper by the philosopher Steve Mason entitled A Semantic Attack on Divine Command Meta-Ethics. Please visit the blog for a link to the paper, as well as other articles and posts on the philosophy of religion, science, ethics, and society. Mason's paper offers an interesting perspective on the debate over the plausibility of a divine command meta-ethics. Now, before we go any further, we need to be clear about what a divine command meta-ethics actually is. Ethical philosophy is often divided into two branches, normative and meta-ethical. Sometimes a third branch, known as applied ethics, is added, but we don't need to worry about that for present purposes. Normative ethics deals largely with practical ethical questions. What is right? What is wrong? What are my duties? What are my obligations? What am I permitted to do? What am I not permitted to do? These questions form the basic building blocks or glue of our ethical lives. In answering those questions, we often identify principles such as do unto others as you would be done by, or we should act so as to maximize the welfare of the greatest number. I'm sure you could think of other principles if you put your mind to it. Meta-ethics asks a different set of questions. It steps back from the practical, everyday domain of normative ethics and asks, what are all these ethical statements and principles that we bandy about in such a carefree manner actually about? That is to say, what are the truth values or truth conditions of these ethical statements? How do we come to know whether they are true or false? And how do they fit in with our overall ontological or metaphysical understanding of reality? A divine command meta-ethics offers a seductively simple answer to those questions by appealing to the person of God. It claims that ethical propositions or statements are made true when they are commanded or willed by God. As readers of my blog will no doubt be aware, I've spent much of my time and many of my posts dealing with the problems arising from different interpretations of a divine command meta-ethics. I would invite you to look up some of these posts in the table of contents on my blog. I must admit that I've never quite been able to understand what is so attractive about a divine command meta-ethics, but I haven't always been able to articulate in the most perspicuous manner what my objection really is. This is where Mason's paper is so useful, because he manages to pin down an objection that is so obvious and yet significant when you think about it. To see what this is, we need to spend a little bit of time laying out a classic objection to a divine command theory. This is the Euthyphro dilemma. Now, as I mentioned earlier, proponents of a divine command theory claim that morality derives its legitimacy from the edicts or directions of God. So let's imagine that you and your significant other go to the cinema some evening. When you arrive in the cinema, there's an extremely long queue for the film you want to go to see. Rather than following all the other saps and queuing up, you decide to cut right to the front of the queue. As you can imagine, this is not a popular move. Everyone begins to object and says what you did was wrong. But you would ask them, what do you mean what I did was wrong? What on earth are you on about? Well, a proponent of a divine command theory would say, your action was wrong because that's what the will or command of God says. Now that's a somewhat trivial example, but you could apply it to a much more serious moral question and moral statement as well. Now, how would you respond to the people who objected to you cutting in front of the queue? You might respond in the manner of Socrates and say, is what I did wrong because it is contrary to the will of God? Or is it contrary to the will of God because it is wrong? I've been phrasing it here in a negative sense. It might be a little bit easier to understand in the positive sense. So, is something good because God wills it? Or does God will it because it is good? This is the classic Euthyphro dilemma. To see why it is a dilemma, imagine we gave the first answer, that something is wrong because it is contrary to the will of God. In that event, we would be leaving morality up to the arbitrary whim of God. That's not an attractive proposition, because God may often command things that are contrary to our common sense understanding of right and wrong. Indeed, according to the Hebrew Bible, he did exactly that when he commanded the genocide of the Canaanites. So what about the other answer? That God only commands things that are good. That might help to preserve our common sense morality, but it would do so at a cost, because it would reduce God's role to that of a mere informant. So moral right and wrong exist independently of God, but he tells us or informs us of this deeper metaphysical truth. The theist then is confronted with a genuine dilemma. On the one hand, they don't want to leave morality up to the arbitrary whim of God because that would contravene their common sense understanding, but nor do they want to reduce God to the role of a mere moral expert or informant. So what can they do? There are a number of responses available to them. They can, if they so wish, decide to bite the bullet and accept one of the horns of the dilemma. So, for instance, they can say that yes, God could command things that are contrary to our common sense understanding, but they would still be morally right. On the other hand, they could happily embrace the idea of God as just a moral expert. I suspect that neither of these responses is truly attractive to the theist. So, a third, and actually now quite popular, response has been developed. This response tries to collapse the horns of the dilemma, or slip between them. This is the idea that God is good, that his being or nature or essence is good, and that his command or will is merely a reflection of this essence or nature. This is the preferred response of William Lane Craig to the Euthyphro dilemma, and it is also adopted by William Alston and Robert M. Adams, although Adams's theory is a little bit more complex and subtle than my discussion can do justice to right now. Okay, so we're now up to speed and we're in a position to start assessing Mateson's argument. Mateson's argument, as the title to his paper suggests, is a semantic attack on divine command theory. In other words, it's an attack on the implications of divine command theory for our understanding of the meaning of moral terms like good, bad, right, or wrong. Mateson accepts the possibility of the third response to the Euthyphro dilemma, that is the semantic equation of God with the good. He says that theists can say that God is good just as we can say that a meter stick is 1 meter long. In fact, that's a direct reference to an argument by William Alston, which I have covered on the blog before. But Mateson thinks that theists do this at a cost. The cost is that they reduce the idea that God is good to a mere triviality or tautology. So it's like saying God is good is the equivalent of God commands what God commands. Now, Mateson's article is unique in its attempt to pin down exactly what this triviality or tautology is and why it is disturbing to the proponents of a divine command theory. As Mateson notes at the outset, several atheist philosophers have intimated or hinted at the triviality or tautology that's invoked by the divine command theory, but they haven't been able to explain why it is so disturbing. For example, James Rachel, who was a very noteworthy ethical philosopher, had the following to say. He said, "On a divine command theory, the doctrine of the goodness of God is reduced to nonsense. It is important to religious believers that God is not only all-powerful and all-knowing, but that he is also good. Yet if we accept divine command theory, this notion is deprived of any meaning. God's commands are good would mean only God's commands are commanded by God, an empty truism." Now, Mateson acknowledges that this is correct, but criticizes Rachel's for not going on to say exactly why the divine command theory is so theologically disturbing. Rachel seems to be saying that divine command theory is nonsense because it gives rise to a tautology, namely that God's commands are commanded by God. But as Mateson points out, a tautology is not necessarily disturbing, because tautologies possess truth values. Indeed, we could say that a tautology is as securely true as anything. The problem is that tautologies lack empirical content, and do not depend on any contingent information. Now, why would that be theologically disturbing? Mateson points to another philosopher, John Chandler, who gets a little bit closer to the problem. He says, "If God's will is the only standard of goodness and rightness, the statement that God is good reduces to the triviality that what God wills is always in conformity with what God wills, which is true whatever he wills. Consequently, it will not be possible to distinguish God from an omnipotent but evil being, or show that he is worthy of worship. Only if there is a criterion of rightness and goodness independent of God does God is good become a significant and non-trivial claim. The central Christian doctrine of God's goodness cannot be significantly asserted to by a subscriber to divine command theory." Now, this is really striking the nail right on the head, but Mateson argues that Chandler needs to spell out his reasoning in a little bit more detail, and needs to use tools from theology, ethics, and the philosophy of language to do so. And the remainder of Mateson's article sets out to support or strengthen Chandler's objection. He starts this with a brief foray into the philosophy of language, and considers whether the claim that divine command theory has semantic implications is correct. Because there is a possibility that proponents of a divine command theory are not making any claims about moral meaning, but are instead making claims about moral truth conditions. This is admittedly a somewhat obscure linguistic or philosophical distinction, but sometimes these distinctions are worthwhile. So, and I'm going to borrow here from a formal definition, a truth condition tells you what state the world must be in order for a sentence to be true. For example, if I were to say that it is raining right now, that sentence would only be true in the event that it is actually raining. In other words, if the world conforms to my sentence. Meaning is a somewhat more elusive concept. It has to do with the understanding or the ability to use a sentence or a term in communicating with other people. Now, according to some theories, the meaning of a sentence is equivalent with its truth conditions. However, there are at least some reasons to doubt that this account of meaning is correct, because we can often understand and use a sentence without knowing what its truth conditions are. It'll actually be easiest to see this if we return to the example of divine command theory. If someone were to claim that the divine command theory gives you the truth conditions of moral sentences, he would in effect be saying that murder, torture, or rape are wrong only insofar as they have been commanded or directed to be wrong by the will of God. But this is not necessarily to say that a sentence like murder is wrong is semantically equivalent to the sentence murder is not commanded or willed by God. In other words, somebody could understand that murder is wrong, understand what that sentence or claim means, without necessarily being able to identify the truth conditions of that sentence. As Mateson points out, divine command theorists aren't necessarily of one mind on the issue of whether or not a divine command theory is about semantics as well as truth conditions. Robert M. Adams, who probably has one of the more famous divine command theories of the past 20 or 30 years, has flip-flopped on this issue, originally claiming that his theory covered moral semantics, but then changing and saying that it only covered moral truth conditions. Now, Mateson thinks there is good reason to think that a divine command theory must cover semantics as well as truth conditions. His reason for this goes back to the kind of classic philosophical or Anselmian understanding of God. According to this understanding, God is a necessary being, which means that he exists in every possible world. Now, truth conditions refer to the states of different possible worlds that have to be the case in order for a sentence or term to be true. But if that is right, and if the Anselmian conception of God is right, it means that sentences such as God is omniscient or God is omnipotent, or indeed that God is morally good, all have the same truth conditions, because they all refer to or point to or rely upon a being that exists in every possible world. But this must give rise to a problem for the proponent of a divine command theory. Why? Well, because if divine command theory is only about truth conditions, then it tells us nothing about goodness as distinct from omniscience or omnipotence. In other words, it does not allow us to distinguish appropriately between the different properties of God. Only if it touches upon semantics will it be able to do this. If we accept that line of reasoning, we can move on to assess why the semantic equation of God's commands with goodness is so theologically or religiously disturbing. It all boils down to the theological significance that is attached to different propositions about God, and this is where we encounter Mateson's key claim. He argues that although tautologies are true, indeed they are securely true, they are religiously insignificant. Now I'll quote directly from the piece just to see what Mateson's reasoning is. He says, "No tautology can contribute to making it the case that, or provide good reasons for thinking that, God is worthy of worship. But, according to traditional theism, the doctrine of God's moral goodness does contribute to making it the case that, or does provide good reasons for thinking that, God deserves worship. So, no meta-ethics that is compatible with traditional theism can reduce the doctrine of God's moral goodness to a tautology." At this point, Mateson develops a long, formal argument pointing out the devastating consequences of this line of reasoning for divine command theory. This argument comes in two stages. The first stage shows how divine command theory must be incompatible with traditional theism. This is because the claim of God's moral goodness must be religiously or theologically significant. And the second part of the argument shows how divine command theory ends up being equivalent to moral nihilism. There's no way I could do justice to this argument in the audio format, so what I'll do is I'll provide a full map of the argument on my blog accompanying this podcast. This will trace out the premises and the inferences in Mateson's argument, and also identify the support for the various premises. Unfortunately, that means that this is where today's episode must come to an end. However, a significant conclusion has been arrived at, and it would be worth emphasizing it with a brief summary. We learned that it is possible for a theist to maintain their commitment to a divine command theory, and thereby semantically equate God's commands with the good, but they do so at a cost to the overall credibility of their worldview. Why? Well, because traditional theism has always held that God has certain properties that make him worthy of being worshipped, and one of the key properties is his moral goodness. However, if moral goodness is defined purely in terms of God's will, it becomes a tautology or empty truism to say that God is good. And no tautology can be religiously significant. That is to say, it can't be enough to make God worthy of our worship. In that case, theists are landed in a real quandary. It will be interesting to see how they get themselves out of it. Thank you.